We get it going by welcoming in our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Hello there, Colin.
Flossing promotes heart health. Did you know that?
I did know that, yes.
Okay, it's just my healthy tip of the day for you downtownians, so those hearts can remain strong for this segment of power every Tuesday.
Well, I appreciate that. It's good that you steer us in the right direction here, and I've taken some of your health tips along the way because, well, they make sense.
Yeah, I don't know how much the flossing one makes sense. I had this wise ass of a roommate once who said, oh, sure, because people who have time to floss don't have stress, which I think completely missed the point. It has to do with the bacteria, I believe. So anyway, you don't have to sweat COVID as much as you have to sweat your heart to floss, people.
That's a good plan right there. I try to do it. I'm not as diligent as I should be, but most days I take it. I had a dentist once tell me, or a hygienist tell me once, if you flossed every day and never brushed, you would probably have better oral health than if you brushed every day but never flossed.
Huh, what a conundrum.
Yes.
I keep it in the shower because that way it's just part of the whole shower package, Kimball.
There you go.
The body, the mouth, and I'm out. Back at it.
There you go. And then the soul, but that requires a deeper cleansing.
Oh, yeah. You need a special kind of waxy floss to floss that soul, man.
Ain't that the truth? Well, yeah. We're going to talk about some seasonal goodies this week and some ghost stories. And thank you for introducing me to a couple of these that were absolutely wonderful. And let's start. We've talked about M.R. James before, but man, did I enjoy "Oh, Whistle and I'll Come to You, My Lad."
The title comes from a line by the Scottish poet Burns, and M.R. James is, for people who don't know him, he's often cited as your go-to ghost story guy. So you think of like a classic English ghost story, M.R. James is the man of the match for many people. He's not necessarily mine, but he's certainly up there. So this particular ghost story dates to 1904. And what James would do is he would write his ghost stories. He'd write like one a year. And you'd go to his rooms. He was a provost at King's College. And so you'd go to his rooms on Christmas Eve if you were in his inner circle. And he would read / perform one of these ghost stories for you. And it was incredibly exciting. And the next morning, you'd go to chapel and hear the choir sing Christmas carols. Quite the thing to go to in the Wayback Machine, I would think, would be King's around Christmas time in the early 20th century. So he has three ghost stories, really, that are a lot better than all of his other ghost stories. And this is the most famous one. It's about a repressed professor, kind of a stand-in for James himself. His main characters are usually stand-ins for him. And this professor goes on a vacation over school holidays to the southeast coast of England. And he wants to do some research. He's a skeptical guy. He doesn't really have a huge capacity for wonder. And a buddy of his is like, oh, can you go to this dig site and sort of root around for me? I want to see if I should go there, if it'd be any good for what I'm looking for. And the professor goes, he ends up finding this whistle buried in the ground, not down too deep. And it's a most problematic whistle for him.
Yes, it is. And, it's not, let's just say, it's not only dogs that might be attracted to this whistle.
Yes, he conjures up something. And James never married. And his idea of camaraderie was like roughhousing with boys, like wrestling on the floor, and not outright homosexual behavior, but a grope and a grab and that kind of thing here and there. And then repressing those, if they were impulses, those impulses. And so this professor has some of this going on. He's going to blow this whistle, and he's going to have a monster enter his life that you wouldn't really think could be a monster. And it's a highly symbolic monster, but it's also a very tactile monster and a very real monster. It's like the everyday world coming to get you, like that Twilight Zone episode where the guy is he's beleaguered by the vacuum in his house and everything. Well, this guy is going to be beleaguered by the sheets, the very sheets of his bed. And it actually makes me think of like Oscar Wilde, and like the scandal with Oscar Wilde was that the sheets would be taken out of his room and they would be stained with excrement from what he had gotten himself up to. So there's that idea coming into play in this particular story. And he has a buddy at this hotel, motel type place he's staying at. And this buddy does him a solid and helps see him through this. But it's like this gripping coastal living nightmare where a lot of it plays out during the day, too. And ghosts during the day are really odd. They freak you out even more. So M.R. James is working with that upending of our spectral expectations, I would say.
And I, in any story, but I think especially in ghost stories, details are so important and bring it to life because you're trying to visualize something that may or may not be real. And James is great at giving those tiny little details that can help you put yourself in that room.
Definitely. And that's a truism of any great writing. I was actually thinking about this today on my walk. When you read like a Chekhov story, it might only be like 2 pages long, and there's no like plot necessarily to speak of. The plot is the accruing of the details and the story that they tell. That's a special way of being able to see the world. It's like I balk at the term writer with a really good writer because you're not really like a writer, oh, I just sit down and I type or write things out. It's how you see the world and how you can convey what you see. Because with M.R. James and with Chekhov and certainly with this story, you see these details where you think, huh, I never noticed that, but that is a true thing. And now I am conscious of all the other times I've noticed that and really not thought anything of it. So those details stack in this story, and it really ratchets up the tension until it's quite unbearable at the end. Like it's smothering for a reader to read this. I mean, James would talk about a pleasing terror. That was like his sort of go-to summation for these kinds of things. And it is a very pleasing terror, and the terror is certainly real through the stacking of those details.
Yeah, and I think that's what you do so well. That's why you're able to, in a very short piece, create characters who seem so fleshed out, so real to us, but it's because you infuse their lives with those details that make us recognize things in ourselves and in people we know.
Exactly. It's that instant tone, too. And you feel like within the space of a sentence that you know that character you've just met. To use like a baseball analogy, the big thing right now in baseball is not to give away outs, right? The worst thing you can do is as a batter is make outs, whether you get hit by the pitch or you get a single or you walk. The key is not to make outs. That's the whole statistical focus. When you're writing, when you're really doing the best stuff, you do not give away a single word. And you'll see that in my work. I never just say, it's a word, whatever. It could be a different word. There is a point to every single word and the arrangement of each and every word in comparison to the words around it. And when you do that, you have that sort of hyper detailing throughout the work. The reader becomes not even conscious that they're reading. They're now having an experience. And that's what M.R. James is doing in A Whistle and I'll Come to You, My Lad. You stop being conscious of reading. And the reason people don't like to read right now is because they read things where you're hyper-conscious of, like, reading, where it's like what your homework used to be, and you just want to get through it and be done. But James gives the immersive experience, and it really just gets that label of Jamesian when it comes to ghost stories, because just saying, oh, I read a ghost story is by M.R. James, I mean, other ones that aren't as good as this one, you can certainly say that. But Oh Whistle is a life experience of that pleasing terror.
It's funny that you mentioned choosing the words so carefully. When I work with high school actors, and not on every script, but when you get a really, really good theater script, and I'll often say to them, there are no wasted words. There are no throwaway words here. So when you're saying those lines, when you're experiencing the lives of those characters, don't throw a word away. They were chosen wisely and carefully.
Sure. You can have a short story that's half a page long. And if it's engineered the right way, because what you're doing is you're working with architecture, you're working with the visual arts, you're working with sound like a musician. And if you bring all of that and more to bear on just half a page of a story, you can have more in that. It's just packed into it, but it doesn't feel overpacked than in most novels. In most novels, people are just padding out word count. You could slap away so many of the words and so many things you read. And just boil it down to an essence. If you take away 3 words out of a sentence of mine or a paragraph, you're going to alter what happens at the end. It's that sort of just that perfection of design, that buttressing. Think about it in hockey. Patrice Bergeron, he's so good as a defensive centerman because he's always maintaining layers, right? That's a form of writing, really. And people don't look at it that way, but the person who's like moved past writing, who still writes, they do look at it that way. So I completely understand what you're saying with your students.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown about some classic ghost stories, and arguably no more classic American ghost story than one that celebrates its 200th anniversary this year, Washington Irving's The Legend of Sleepy Hollow.
Right, and I think it's what people think of in this country is maybe not so much a ghost story as the ultimate Halloween story. And it's a ghost story. We'll make liberal use of that term, but it's also kind of a fake news story, and it's very much a story about anxiety and letting your fear get the most of you. It's almost like a parallel in its time for when the online mob comes for you these days. A lot of times when the mob comes for you, as I've learned, you end up doing yourself in because you don't stand in. You freak, and you run, and then you're cooked. It's all over at that point. And that is what our man Ichabod Crane, of course, does in this very story, which Washington Irving actually wrote when he was in England. So it has that insider/outsider quality. He's away from home, and he's also writing stories set in England in pieces and vignettes and nonfiction works while he's in England. So he's an outsider there. He kind of has this whole dual outsider-insider thing going with both the States and with England. And he puts this all together into a book that everyone just refers to as the sketchbook. And I think Orson Welles, too, was riffing off that very idea of the sketchbook when he's in England and he's on TV for the BBC, and it's called Orson Welles' Sketchbook. He would have known the Washington Irving and all of that. And it's really this modernistic collection, which you wouldn't expect 200 years ago, because some of it is like long fiction, some of it's like a scene or just a vignette, some of it is nonfiction, these travelogue-type essay pieces, and he's like, it can all go together, and it works. So he has the story, of course, set in Tarrytown here in New York, and Ichabod wants to woo this lady, and he has this rival, the wonderfully named Brom Bones. It's kind of like a Dickensian name, right? Like Gradgrind, that kind of thing. And he gaslights Ichabod, and Irving essentially tells you at the end. He's like, oh, yeah, people will be like, oh, you scared away that guy, and Brom Bones would have this big smile on his face. Like, he sort of tells you. It's not outright a supernatural story, but our man M.R. James, he had a tip. He wrote an essay about the way to write a ghost story. And he said, leave these loopholes. Make it so it could kind of go, it could be this, or it could be that. And I think that's really what you see in many of the best ghost stories. They might not be ghost stories at all, or they totally could be. So it's this harvest festival, and Ichabod is there, and he wants to do his a-wooing, and he doesn't get the right time to do so. He rides home. He's chased by the ghost of the Hessian, and many people know what happens on the bridge and the fiery-tossed pumpkin head.
And there is humor in there, as there often is in the best ghost tales, to have that balance, because it's such a fine line between fear and humor. And, boy, nowhere is that more evident than the wonderful story you shared with me from Richard Middleton, The Ghost Ship, which is, I would say, the only laugh-out-loud funny ghost story that I've ever read.
Yeah, it's hilarious. It's just, you could call it like one of the, it's so witty and it's so winsome. And out of these three stories, I love them all, but it's easily my favorite. It's one of my favorite things that I've ever read. And Middleton is, no one really knows Middleton. He died when he was 29. He suffered from what at the time was called melancholia, which isn't just a track on the Who sell out. It was a code word for depression. And he had been prescribed chloroform to help him with that depression. I guess it was sort of the Prozac of the time. And he deliberately overdosed on that. And so he was not known to many readers at all. He wrote some book reviews. And it's ironic, of course, that this man so tormented should write something so just inventive and funny in a different kind of ghost story. It's about a coastal community in England. They're farmers largely, and this ship of ghosts of the title it crashes into the garden. And the ghosts are like, damn, this sucks. What are we going to do? they have intercourse with the people of the town. And so it's so skillful the way he maintains the divide between the living and the dead.
Yes.
And yet they transact. Like,
oh, yes, especially when, you know, your ghost ship might ruin the turnip crop.
Right. Well, that's a big thing. The people in the town are like, oh, bugger. Can't afford to lose the turnips. So you have like the captain of the ghost ship, and he sort of talks like he's from a different time too, right? Which is, so you get this like different vernacular, and I mean it's truly like laugh out loud funny. If you sit in Starbucks and you read this story, and then there's also like the problem of what's everybody going to do, and then of course like some of the more like lascivious wenches of the town like falling in love with some of the ghosts. And, like, the town drunk is like, this is cool. I like this. And so, like, the ghost ship eventually departs, and it doesn't just take ghosts with it.
Right.
There's, like, a straggler or two. And then, like, 7 years later, like, someone comes walking up the beach. It's like, oh, man, you wouldn't believe what happened on the ghost ship.
Oh, it was great. I absolutely loved it. And yeah, you talked about him. He was, what, 28, 29 years old when he died?
Yeah, he was 29. And it's just such a surprising story, isn't it? It's what you want as a reader, because there's no precedent for it. It's so fresh. It's so innovative. And it's like he had this idea. What you want to have a lot of times as an artist, as a writer, you want to have an idea that when you think it through after, it sounds simple, but no one else would have thought of it. Do you know what I mean? And then it becomes one of those, I call it the, why didn't I think of that idea? Like Paul McCartney had that when he wrote Yesterday, right? He's all incredulous that he wrote this melody, and he didn't like have them record it for a bit. He was going around and asking everyone, like, have you heard this? Like, where did I nick this from? And so that could have been like sort of what was going through Middleton's head, because I mean it's a delicious idea, and it's not unscary. At the same time, it's completely unpredictable. It's why we read.
Yes, and I want to visit a village like Fairfield, where, you know, this kind of thing maybe could be expected to happen.
I think you can do so much anyway. I mean, I would with a coastal setting. I think that they are just they're ripe for the confection that is life. And you mentioned having these opposites. I would maintain that you cannot have tragedy without comedy and vice versa. Everything in this world, or most things at least, they exist in relation to something else. And when you do not give the both, you undercut what you're trying to do. You're not providing, it's like a map. You need like, oh, the scale. This means like 10 miles or whatever it is. You need that in a piece of prose art. You need the contrast. And because that's how life is. Like, if you've got to be grim, but if you've ever been in, like, the ER and somebody's dying and the family is camped out in, like, a vigil, there are still jokes. That still happens.
Right.
Not just like, oh, wow, let's make a joke to make this a little bit easier. It's just the stuff of life. And so, in a way, it's ironic, but in another way, it makes perfect sense to me that Middleton, who was suffering like he did, would know this and could bear this out in this story that is just the most wonderful, improbable, surprising, fresh, innovative ghost story that you're going to find.
That it is. Three wonderful reads to check out this week as we talk with Colin Fleming. By the way, our conversation with Colin about autumnal pop culture will be on our podcast this week. That'll be released tomorrow morning at 12:01 in the a.m. Check out Colin's work at ColinFlemingLit.com. Subscribe to the Many Moments More blog, now at over 800 blog entries.
Yeah, and none about flossing. So you've heard my lesson on that, and you will be spared any others, Tony.
Right, but I will do it. I will take your sage advice nonetheless, and I look forward to talking with you again next Tuesday.
Sounds good.
Thank you, Colin. Colin Fleming on Downtown.